I think sustainability of NDIS needs to come back to the fact that mainstream society is being a free rider. The NDIS will always have to continue to do the heavy lifting in community participation for people with disability if things like the Australian Disability Strategy, the various inclusion acts within the states, the agreements between the states and the feds, if that stuff's not acted upon, if mainstream society doesn't lift its game, well, the NDIS is going to have to continue doing the heavy lifting. Citizens with disability deserve, you know, be able to exercise their human rights on an equal basis with others. And they need, you know, to be able to access housing to be able to do that. It creates so many expensive blockages in the system, and it pushes people into unsafe and vulnerable situations in terms of their housing.
Hi, I'm Dr. George Stoller-Porras, and welcome to Reasonable Necessary, Australia's pivot podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Stoller Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land and pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, I'm joined by Australia's Disability Discrimination Commissioner, Rosemary Chaos. We chat about her fight for disability rights on the world stage and what she thinks about changes to the NDIS back home. We also cover the Disability Law Commission and the Disability Discrimination Act. Check it out. Hey, Rosemary, welcome to the show.
Hey, George, good to be with you.
Thank you. I've been waiting so long to interview you. You've been very busy flying around the world, as you often do. I want to start by asking you, what's it like being Australia's Disability Discrimination Commissioner?
Oh, look, it's something I've thought about for a few years now. I must admit, I've done a lot of work with the Commission over the years as an academic. And because I've been so heavily involved in human rights as a human rights lawyer, and so it sort of seemed a bit of a natural extension to my career. And for me, academia and the legal advice that and the engagement that I've had with the disability community over the years, working on the negotiations of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and now being over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years being heavily involved in the monitoring, the parallel reports, and now as a member of the committee, I enjoy the opportunity that it takes my academic knowledge and makes it a bit more action-oriented. And so I thought I was enjoying that sort of role, that more engaging with governments and really trying to progress the rights of people with disability, that I give it a crack at home. The opportunity presented itself and I was incredibly lucky to be appointed. It's also incredibly daunting. I've taken on the role at a time when there is just a swathe of policy reform on the agenda. And so there's potentially a big change afoot, but there's also a big chance that we could, you know, go backwards, and that's also concerning.
Well, we don't want to go backwards.
No.
You've done, as you alluded to, a lot of this work from an academic perspective, and You've also done it on the international level. I think you're still the chairperson. Are you?
No, not currently the chairperson. I was the chairperson. I'm now currently the vice chair of the committee.
Tell us about the Black Committee. I'm really interested in, anything to do with the United Nations. It sounds so exciting, and I'd love to hear about that.
Well, the convention is one of the 10 international human rights instruments that forms part of contemporary human rights as framed under the United Nations. So there's 193 member states of the United Nations, and they came together to agree to promote and protect the rights of people with disability. And part of the binding nature of that instrument, so that means that states have legally agreed to meet those obligations and to act in good faith. So one of the articles of the convention sets up a mechanism to monitor state parties' action and progress, and that committee is the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And so that committee acts as a forum, a quasi-judicial role to review states, to receive individual complaints, a bit like national human rights institutions like our Australian Human Rights Commission here in Australia receives complaints. So if someone feels that they've exhausted all their domestic remedies, they can go to the international level and say, hey, my human rights have been abused. And the committee, if it's admissible, will consider it and make findings and put forward views to the government, the state party, about what they should do about it.
That's so interesting. Have you had any complaints about Australia?
Oh, yeah, lots, but I can't participate. One of the obligations is independence, and so I need to be seen as being incredibly independent. So I can't participate in any of the Australian reviews. I can't participate in any of the communication considerations, or if the committee decided to do an inquiry into Australia, I couldn't participate in any of the decision-making, any of the examination or any of the findings.
Then maybe not Australia. What other countries have you had a go at addressing some of the human rights concerns?
Well, I've been heavily involved in the UK inquiry. We've just done a follow-up review to the inquiry into the United Kingdom that where the committee examined the impact of austerity measures on people with disability. And so that's been a really interesting process, and it's been really quite damning on the English and the whole kingdom's governments about the impact on people with disability that started with those austerity measures back in 2012. So it's really quite worrying what's happening there for people with disability. The other area that I've been involved in has been the various individual communications from places other than Australia. I mean, being a lawyer, I enjoy the opportunity to practice my law, and this gives me an avenue to do that. And it's always challenging to work in different jurisdictions. I mean, the civil jurisdiction is very different to our common law jurisdiction. So I enjoy the intellectual legal challenge.
Can you tell us about what happened in the UK? Because I think that that's an interesting example of how disability services can be pulled out from under people's feet.
Yeah, well, this was right. There was things imposed upon people with disability, like the second bedroom tax. So if someone had a bedroom in their house that wasn't being used, and say a a person with disability might be using it for a support person that stays over. They might be using it as a space for all their equipment. I mean, you think about English homes, you know, the one up, one down. They're only small if you've got, you know, equipment such as portable hoists or wheelchairs or shower chairs or, you know, any number of things that need to be stored. You may need a spare room to be able to do that. But it was a blanket type decision. And there were the way assessments, different programs were cut completely. Different programs were cut back. There was the devolution of the responsibility to various sections of the kingdom. So Scotland took over responsibility, Wales took over responsibility, Northern Ireland had a degree of responsibility. Their parliament at one point was completely dysfunctional. So it's been really difficult because they're now operating in a devolved situation. So each of the countries have different standards, and yet the Westminster government still holds responsibility on some areas. So it's really quite problematic. And they're now looking at using very functional-based, where have we heard this before? Very functional-based assessments for their support programs. And they're talking about machine learning and AI. And I put forward to them a very cautionary tale about what can happen when the human lens and consideration of the person in a whole is not applied in those situations, as we saw from RoboJet.
Is there anything that we can learn from the UK experience?
Well, I mean, I think in lots of respects, there's lots the UK can learn from us at the moment, i.e. the RoboJet experience. Some of the debate that's going on now around the NDIS and its reform, and the experience that we've had with the Disability Royal Commission. The situations are not that different, unfortunately.
Let's talk about the changes to the NDIS Act that are currently before the Parliament. You witnessed at the Senate inquiry in May, I think that was, and you raised some significant concerns. You said that the bill shifts the NDIS away from the human rights model of disability and away from a rights-based approach. How exactly does the NDIS bill do that? Can you help us understand that?
Well, in many ways, I mean, in very particular ways, it diminishes the central theme of the CRPD about individual choice and control, personal autonomy, participation and inclusion. And I mean, fundamentally, the raison d'etre for the CRPD, the objects and purposes of the CRPD, is for people with disability to enjoy and be able to exercise all human rights and fundamental freedoms on an equal basis with others. And I mean, that's the principal objective and purpose of the CRPD. And so the bill should reflect that. But what it does is it seems to bring in a lot of wiggle words that don't get to the guts of enshrining that it's about realising the human rights of people with disabilities so we can enjoy and exercise our rights on an equal basis with others.
Specifically, in the NDIS bill, are there particular areas that concern you in terms of sections of the bill?
They're mechanisms that enable self-determination. So I mean, there's two things about that. There was very little info in the bill about the rules and regulations that would support the bill and how it would be applied. And that gets to individual circumstances. So how is it going to operate? Okay, the bill might say this, but how's it actually going to be applied. And so we had, normally you would get much more understanding around the rules and regulations when a bill comes before Parliament. I'm also concerned that there remains mechanisms for substitute decision-making. And I mean, the nominee provisions are still there. And it was all quite rushed. It seemed like they were pushing the bill through Parliament before the Royal Commission response. And so it wasn't accounting for the recommendations regarding the reforms to guardianship and substitute decision making.
Right.
I mean, one of the big concerns for the NDIS review is some of the recommendations around the provision of services. And there looks to be the potential for the imposition of blanket rules on people with disability that takes away their individual choice. So there's a couple of areas that this is concerning. The first one is about registration. So registration may be one measure for protection, but it can't be a paternalistic blanket rule. And I mean, it's not even written in stone yet, but it's having implications for people now. The imposition of rules that put people with disability unable to hire family members who are trusted people in their lives, and they're no longer able to provide support. I mean, my own personal situation is I'm not an NDIS participant. I mean, I must have put five nieces and nephews through university doing part-time work for me to support me. I mean, whilst I realise that families don't always fulfil those roles, but for some people it may be their choice. Chosen people can keep you safe from all forms of violence and abuse. And mandatory registration has not stopped perpetrators of violence in the lives of people with disabilities. And as I said, I mean, I know families can present a risk, but people's lives and circumstances need to be understood in their individual context and not just assumed that everybody is exploiting people with disability or that the person with disability isn't capable of choosing who they want to make their own decisions. And I mean, that goes to the first overarching general principle of the CRPD about autonomy and personal choice.
Well, I think that was exactly what the NDIS was meant to be about.
Yeah.
What reforms or changes would you want to see made to the NDIS?
I would like to see it start out with a very clear human rights objective. And I think there needs to be confidence that we're not setting up any mechanisms for segregation within the legislation and within the program. So 24-hour support, we're seeing the 3-to-1 ratio, which will potentially enforce people into group homes and congregate living. Mandatory registration for support workers reduces choice and control for participants. The NDIS can become, because of its value, can become very much a political football. And I would really like it to be seen for what it is. Is a program that ensures people with disability can exercise our rights. And I mean, the classic example is the furor over the use of sex weapons and not being seen as reasonable and necessary. And I mean, it's like the tail wagging the dog. I mean, there is a very limited amount of people, a very small amount of the small amount of people in Australia that have access to the NDIS are using their NDIS plan to access sex workers. And the nuance is being left out and people's individual circumstances ignored for this rush for a populist position that paints people with disabilities as spending every Friday night at a brothel. And it discounts the barriers that people with disability face. Couples who can't have sexual relationships without intermediaries. People who can't self-gratify themselves. It's not looking at it from the actual barriers that people with impairments face. They are looking at it from a very ableist point of view. And I mean, they are accessing sex workers for very legitimate disability barrier reasons. But we don't see this played out in the public discourse. And we always hear things like the NDIS and then the value of it as if people with disabilities are costing Australians so much money. But we've been paying for it with the loss of our rights in living with people that we don't choose to live with, of having to live in these situations just so we can get up and get out of bed of the day.
On the issue of the 1-3 recommendations from the NDIS review, clearly that's one of the more controversial recommendations, and it's controversial, as you said, because of the possible ramifications that it might force people into living situations that are not of their choosing. What would you say to Professor Bonahady, who has essentially said that that is the way forward from a sustainability perspective? What would you say to him?
I don't think it's the only show in town. I think sustainability of NDIS needs to come back to the fact that mainstream society is being a free rider. The NDIS will always have to continue to do the heavy lifting in community participation for people with disability if things like the Australian Disability Strategy, the various inclusion acts within the states, the agreements between the states and the feds, if that stuff's not acted upon, if mainstream society doesn't lift its game, well, the NDIS is going to have to continue doing the heavy lifting. I spoke at an NDIS conference back in 2016. I said exactly those, well, not exactly those words, but I intimated exactly that point, and I'm still saying it 8 years later.
It's such an important point, and I know that one of the things that we need to do is make society more accessible and inclusive. And when we do that, then the NDIS won't be carrying that financial weight, because, like you said, there's so many other parts of our lives that need to be addressed. I'm thinking now about the situation around housing and the fact that there are so many situations where people with disabilities can't find housing. One way of moving forward on this would be universal standards around housing design, but not all states are on board, and New South Wales is one state that is yet to sign up. What would you have to say to the New South Wales Premier about this?
Well, I wholeheartedly support any move towards accessible housing. And minimum standards are at least one step in the right direction. I'd like to see that this is central to actions under Australia's Disability Strategy and the agreements with states, and a fundamental aspect of the New South Wales Inclusion Act. New South Wales citizens with disability deserve, be able to exercise their human rights on an equal basis with others. And they need, to be able to access housing to be able to do that. It creates so many expensive blockages in the system, and it pushes people into unsafe and vulnerable situations in terms of their housing, whether it's an inaccessible house, whether it's a boarding house where they're being exploited, whether it's a group home where they're vulnerable to violence and abuse. It just creates so many more problems. And I would say to the New South Wales government, you really need to think about where you're going to get a better outcome. And I would say the same to the WA government. It's also not coming towards the minimum standards.
And I would add to that that the cost of not making housing accessible for everyone means that we need to retrofit houses, and we need to essentially spend a lot more down the line. So it's actually a smart thing to do economically, isn't it?
Well, yes, and of course, then it just reinforces that stereotype of people with disability costing the community a lot of money. Because when you've got a retrofit, it's a lot harder to do it after the fact. It's much better to do it when you go in there. We saw it with the disability standards under the DDA for access to premises. The Property Council talking about the wanton profligacy of the standards, that it was going to, wipe out the property development industry. And we finally got something into the Building Code of Australia. It's the only action that seems to, of all the policy objectives and attempts over the years, that's the only thing that seems to have made any inroads. And that is a tiny, tiny aspect of, accessible housing.
I remember growing up as a child, and your friends would have birthday parties and all sorts of things like that, and it would make such a difference if houses had
Oh.
basic accessibility.
Yeah, and look, if we continue with the status quo, we're just going to end up with people living in group homes. There's going to be no inclusion within the community for those sorts of situations. You'll have people living in inappropriate situations. Even people that can only afford and find accessible apartments. Imagine if there's only one lift and you're on the 15th floor and you use a wheelchair and it's out for a month while they redo the motor. Please. It's a classic denial of human rights. We can live independently and be part of the community, and we can't if we can't live in the community.
I want your perspective on the Disability Law Commission. We're yet to see the government response to that, and we know that a very strong recommendation was, for half of the commissioners to phase out group homes. Do you support that recommendation?
Yes.
Why?
Look, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be flippant, George, but really, segregation is, it just denies so many fundamental principles of human rights. I mean, segregation, the first binding international instrument at international law was the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. The overarching objective about ICERD was to end segregation and segregation policies. Segregation needs to be considered as de facto discriminatory. And it was a central issue in if we're going to talk about drafter intent, it was a central issue in the drafting negotiations for the CRPD. It was about ending the segregation, or what some activists referred to as the social apartheid, of people with disability. And we've seen with the Disability Royal Commission that those sorts of living situations leave people vulnerable to violence, abuse, and exploitation and neglect.
There's a lot of recommendations in the report. Which of these recommendations do you want to see the government prioritise?
Oh, look, that's a really tricky question, George. There's many areas that the Disability Royal Commission didn't examine, and there's lots of areas where the commissioners didn't agree. So fundamental for me is some sort of whole of government roadmap, A, for transforming our society, but in particular areas, I think it's critical that there's a roadmap to break the segregate mechanism, the mechanisms that allow for segregation in housing, education, employment. I also think that criminal justice really needs some heavy-duty work done. Like, it needs urgent reform. And just in the last week, we've seen it again. You know, 13-year-old First Nations girl, reportedly with an intellectual disability. So, you know, how often have we got to see these scenes of the criminalisation of disability fundamentally? I mean, we saw in the video, and we've heard from the various information that's come out, that it was in response to her behaviour. So how are we supporting that young girl, and how are we breaking the pathways to the criminal justice system? I think lots of the recommendations don't go far enough. The Disability Rights Act, my concern there is that it has very limited provisions. I think it creates unnecessary overlap by creating another commission when we've got the Australian Human Rights Commission. We've got my role that, you know, if that was enhanced, the commission's role was enhanced, more money could go into programs and policies rather than replicating another commission. As I said before, I think there's fairly limited provisions. They cherry-picked provisions from CRPD. So for me, the Australian Human Rights Commission's Free and Equal Reform Program for a Human Rights Act is a stronger, more holistic approach. And the way that we should recognise that, you know, people with disability are part of our community. And I mean, I can't argue for desegregation for all my working career and then say, oh, but I think a discrete, separate, segregated Disability Rights Act is the way to go. And I think it doesn't allow for a strong intersectional approach. I think we really do need to look at the volume on First Nations people with disability and see that as a prioritisation. And I'm sorry there wasn't a dedicated volume and stronger recommendations around women and girls with disabilities. And we fundamentally need to come to grips with the engagement of people with disability in policy discourse. And we need to have mechanisms that truly meet the obligations, obligations under Article 4, subparagraph 3, which is the engagement and close consultation and active involvement of people with disability in policy and policy reform. And Australia needs to come to grips with policy that's got an intersectional focus.
I absolutely agree with that. And one thing that I'm hearing you say is you don't want separate things for people with disabilities. You want equality and you want to end segregation. And you know, I can totally relate to that. I'm interested, though. Is the minister listening to you, Rosemary?
If the minister... My problem is, which minister? Is it the Attorney General? See, for me, disability isn't a DSS issue. It isn't an NDIS issue. It's a whole of government, whole of Australia issue. People with disability don't exist in a narrow little prism of services as defined by DSS or their NDIS participation status as defined by NDIS. So for me, it's collective ministers. And one thing I would be saying to the collective is that there's an opportunity for strong global leadership in the area of disability and human rights. Believe me, Australia's not alone of, you know, having it all sorted out. But there is they have a wealth of policy reform on the table from the Disability Royal Commission, the NDIS review, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, and the Commission's Free and Equal proposal. So much of the work has been done. People with disabilities have bled their hearts and souls out for the last 14 years since the shutout report. And what I'd like to see now is some due respect to all that personal information, that evidence, and laying their lives bare, and for some commitment to upholding our rights come back for us.
Can I ask you about the Disability Discrimination Act? It's been around for a long time now, and you're essentially you're in a role where you can influence that act. Is it working? And what do you think we need to do to get real outcomes from the Act?
Oh, look, I think a very learned friend, and I say this wisely, a very learned friend from the legal profession, who was a member of the High Court, Michael Kirby, said many years ago that discrimination law is littered with the bodies of the wounded, and the DDA is not exempt from that commentary. The DDA really is not fit for purpose anymore. And it's becoming basically dysfunctional in terms of being able to meet its purpose and objective. Direct discrimination is still really unworkable because of the decision of Purvis back in 2006, even following legislative adjustments in 2009. And now we've got the Sklavos decision in 2017, which makes indirect discrimination and reasonable adjustments really quite problematic. So we really need, and we've got we've essentially got multiple definitions of discrimination in our discrimination law in Australia. We have four siloed instruments that sets up a different standard of discrimination depending on your identity or life status, your personal characteristics. So for me, that's problematic, especially when discrimination is about equality. So how can you have equality if acts of discrimination are being measured differently for different groups? And this is where I come back to the free and equal proposal. Not only are they proposing a Human Rights Act, they're proposing reform of Australia's anti-discrimination laws to have a robust legislative framework behind it. So the equality provisions within the Human Rights Act can act in unison with strong anti-discrimination law.
Clearly, as far as for the Human Rights Act is one of your priorities, what other priorities do you have as our Disability Discrimination Commissioner?
I've been engaging with the community sector. I've been working on my priorities and have some term goals that include greater human rights understanding within the executive, the administration and civil society. It's really quite difficult to expect reform to happen if we don't have a strong understanding of human rights. And I think there needs to be a stronger understanding of our obligations and the ways in which we can protect and promote the rights of people with disability. I mean, if we're serious about having our rights recognised, then we should feel confident that those administrators understand the obligations that they hold. So I think there's some educative pieces in there, but I think there's being a critical player in terms of getting some of the direction and the roadmaps together to get the recommendations from the various suites of law reform and policy reform that are in front of us. Now, a lot of that will formulate a lot more clarity once we get responses from the government to the Disability Royal Commission, the NDIS review, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights. So, you know, I'm not in a holding pattern. I'm still having lots of conversations and working through my term goals, but those three responses will have a significant impact on how I direct my energies.
And before we go, what message do you have for the government with respect to upholding the human rights of people with disabilities in our country?
Listen to this podcast? Sorry, George.
I like it.
Well, commitment is the first thing that we need. We're either going to commit to an inclusive society, and that means committing to an inclusive education system, you know, committing to people living independently and being included in the community, and committing to people with disability being able to have opportunities of employment that are freely chosen in the open labour market. I mean, that people with disability have personal autonomy in their lives and are safe and free from violence, abuse, neglect and exploitation.
There's a saying for them, and I do hope that the government listens to our podcast. Rosemary, it's been a very, very interesting and informative chat. Thank you for your time, Rosemary.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been very enjoyable.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Visual and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback. So please share your thoughts with us in the comment section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.